Ugh! Immediately, Juma grabbed up two handfuls of dirt. He flung one handful in the direction of the young man. Idiot! He started toward the young man. Closer, he threw the other handful of dirt. Go away! What do you think you're doing, stupid? Juma stooped to pick up a stick. His eyes now on Juma, the young man stepped sideways into the jungle. Immediately, the foliage covered him. Son of a bitch! Juma yelled after him. Why don't you come into this sanctuary? Turning back to Fletch, Juma said, At least this half of the sanctuary. He dropped the stick. I wanted to see how long he'd stay that way. Juma waved his hand. For the rest of his life, he'd die that way. Why was he doing it? Who knows? Who cares? Some of these people live in another world. They know about radios, telephones. Tiresome, someone that age. Thanks for bringing me the water. Juma picked up the empty jug. Carr said he'll be along later with your lunch. Juma began to walk down the trail. Go ahead, eat in the midday. It will make you more hot, more tired, sweat more. You Europeans insist on consuming and wasting, just to keep yourself sick. The young man with the spear did not return, that Fletch could see or feel. Fletch was hungry for lunch well before Carr arrived. They sat cross-legged on the ground in the center of a wide bare spot. They ate fish sandwiches with a third jug of water. For all the water Fletch was drinking, he was urinating little. Carr said, I thought you'd appreciate a morning working alone. I enjoyed it. Fletch told Carr about the young man who had spent much of the morning at silent attention watching him, and that Juma had come along and chased him away. Sounds like a Maasai Moran, a warrior. A mti, an mti. They're not allowed to carry shields anymore. Why did he carry a spear? Because of the snakes. Sounds sensible. Maybe I should carry a spear. Pretty far south for a Maasai these days, but you never can tell. They're nomads, follow the grazing. What tribe is Juma's? I'm pretty sure he's Kikuyu. There are over 40 tribes in East Africa. And over all these centuries, the tribes have remained segregated enough, distinct enough, so that you can tell one from the other? Pretty much so. To this point in history, the political struggles in Africa have almost nothing to do with ideologies, East versus West, socialism versus free enterprise, communism versus capitalism. The struggles for power are among the tribes. I wish you'd tell your chaps in Washington that. I'll write them a letter. There's even a tribe near here which denies it exists. No one but its own members know its true name. You meet a member of that tribe, and he will always tell you he's a member of some other tribe. Prove to him he's not, and he'll say, well, and insist he is a member of even another tribe. They're a secret tribe. They camouflage themselves among all the other tribes. The true name of the tribe may be the Wata. Sure, Fletch grinned. What a tribe. I got it. You don't believe me? Was Juma working with you this morning? Yes. Are you paying him? Am I paying you? No. Carr smiled. You're working off that mosquito net you and Barbara wrecked last night. Oh. Fletch scratched his elbow. You know about that. Raffles mentioned to Sheila this morning that someone will have to spend a day sewing. Sorry about that. There is a technique to doing what you want to do under mosquito netting. You'll learn. So why is Juma working for you if he's not being paid? I don't know. I didn't ask him to come with us. I didn't ask him to work. I guess he just wants to be with us. Are you paying the other men? Of course. Why does Juma want to be with us? Perhaps because he loves you? Loves who? Loves you, loves Barbara. Do I mean love? He's very curious about you both. He watches you very closely, how you walk, how you talk, relate to each other and others. What and when you eat, drink, how you dress, what your bodies are like, and how you use them, your minds. I'm very curious about Juma, too. It's a very dear relationship, if you find you can relate to it at all decently. He's interested, but uncritical. Can you understand that? The other night, standing on the sidewalk outside the Norfolk, he said something which totally baffled Barbara and me. He said he doesn't decide who are his friends and who are not his friends. He said something like making such decisions is very hard, but he may have meant very harsh. Generally very uncritical, Carr repeated. He certainly made a fast decision about the young man with the spear standing in the bush over there. Instantly he picked up things and started throwing them at him. He swore at him. Yeah, well, a modern man like Juma is apt to have great impatience with other people, especially people his own age who cling to tribal ways. They don't like that spear-shaking image of Africa. More quietly, Fletch said, he certainly seems to have made a rather harsh decision about Sheila. Yes, Carr said, he inherited that. There is a distinct prejudice here against people of East Indian extraction. Why? Throughout Africa, throughout much of the Third World, in fact, Indians own most of the dukkas, the stores. They do most of the trading, the buying and selling. Therefore, the native populations think the Indians have a disproportionate share of the goods and the money. Do they feel the Indians exploit them? Don't we all feel a little exploited by the shopkeeper? We give him more money for something than he paid for it, and we know it. Then, with his profits, the shopkeeper goes off and builds a house better than any we could afford. Trouble is, some of the poorest Africans I know are of East Indian extraction. Some of the richest, too. Sheila was born in Kenya. She was a working woman when I met her. She worked for a car rental agency. So Juma crosses her off completely as a Kenyan, as a woman, as a person. Carr shrugged. Prejudice is like that. Are you surprised to find prejudice in Africa? Fletch had finished his lunch. Carr, I went to the jail yesterday. Carr's eyebrows shot up. Oh? To see my father. They let you in? They would have. My father sent out the message that he wasn't in. Cute. I thought so. Can't fault old Fletcher for his humor. At least I proved one thing to myself. What's that? There is a Walter Fletcher. Did you doubt that? Fletch removed a speck from his eye. I think Barbara was beginning to hope you were my father. Carr laughed. I'm flattered. We came to meet my father, you see, and we met you instead. Carr refolded the brown paper in which he had brought lunch. If you keep cutting trail, I'll go get the corkscrew. So I know Walter Fletcher exists, Fletch said, which I really didn't know before. He sighed. And for once in my life, I know exactly where he is. Chapter 30. Hapanikitu. Barbara and Carr knelt on the ground watching the soil as it came up the screw to the surface. Sheila stood over them, arms akimbo, watching, saying nothing. On the four sides of the earth screw's frame, Juma, Fletch, Winston, and Raffles turned the wheels, sending the screw into the ground. For the most part, the earth was soft. Forcing the screw slowly into the ground wasn't very hard work. Carr's fingers crumbled a piece of rotten wood that surfaced. Nothing, he repeated. An hour or so after Carr had left Fletch, the derelict-looking jeep snorted up the trail Fletch had cleared. Looking huge and ridiculous, the aluminum corkscrew stuck far out of the back of the jeep. 12 meters behind the jeep, men carried the top of the shaft. Barbara, wearing her conga, rode in the jeep with Carr. The rest, including Sheila, walked beside the jeep. It seemed an invasion of the solitude Fletch had enjoyed in the jungle. It was fairly easy, tipping the corkscrew up and making it even on the ground. The top of the screw shaft reached its lowest point. The wheels could turn no further. Right, Carr said. Bring it up. It was easier unscrewing the earth. They continued to watch what earth came up with the screw. Pity we're not in the well drilling business, Carr said. At least sometimes we find water. Ever find oil? Fletch asked. Not even hair grease. Wrestling the corkscrew around, they tried three other places in that clearing that afternoon. Fletch tried a few pleasantries until he realized they weren't appreciated. They didn't find a lost Roman city, but he had enjoyed the day. Hapanakitu, Carr said. Nothing. Let's go back to camp. There's always tomorrow. Chapter 31. Hello, Juma said. Stay where the crocodiles are used to us. They are very territorial, you see. Naked, Barbara and Fletch were swimming in the river. Naked, Juma sat on a rock in the river watching them. Crocodiles? Barbara stood up in the river. Haven't you seen them? Fletch asked. Crocodiles that eat people? I don't think they're particular. Fletch, Barbara whispered, Juma's naked. So are we. What does he mean? That there's nothing sexual between us, among us? I'll ask him. Screw crocodiles. Barbara started for the riverbank in haste. Never even got to wash my hair. Fletch climbed up onto the rock and sat beside Juma. Barbara wants to know if there's nothing sexual among us. What does she mean? Among us three, I guess she means. You and her. Barbara wants a baby by me? That would be odd. No, she doesn't. We three were just naked together. People put on clothes to be sexual, don't they? People do many things to be sexual. What else are clothes for? Pockets. Juma was rubbing the fingers of his right hand against his leg. Africans don't have pockets. We have nothing to put in them. The red stain on his fingers was not coming off. People can be sexual with each other whether they wear clothes or not. True. Juma was looking at the mark on the lower right side of Fletch's stomach. Juma said, So you are partly black. And blue. I have never seen such a thing before. Is that the way a baby would look if Barbara and I had a baby? I don't think so. No. It looks odd. Black people do not turn white where they are hit. Who hit you? Did someone in Kenya hit you? Why are your fingers red? Miraa. What's miraa? You don't know miraa? It's a drug we chew, a pleasure drug. Like marijuana? What's marijuana? A pleasure drug. It leaves the fingers red and the gums and tongue. Juma showed Fletch how red his gums and tongue were. Also, I suppose our insides. It's not very good. One of the men gave me some. Juma nodded up the riverbank toward the cook tent. You can buy some in any store which has banana leaves over the door. I read some of that book you lent me, Weep Not Child. Juma snorted. Ngugi blames white people for almost everything, including inventing war. As if they were gods. Juma put his hand on the back of Fletch's neck and squeezed. Are you a god, Fletch? Tell me about my father. He's all right. Juma returned to trying to rub the red stain off his fingers. A bit of a mutata. What's mutata? Troublesome. He's a nuisance? Juma laughed. Once he rode into Narok on his motorcycle, slowly, slowly, dragging behind him with a rope around its neck a hyena. He still rides a motorcycle. He insisted some people bet him the night before he could not lasso a hyena and bring it into Narok by the second hour of daylight the next day. Juma laughed again. Trouble was, no one remembered having made such a bet with him. No one would admit to such a bet. He sounds crazy. It's all right. No one likes hyenas much. There was a particularly loud chattering from the jungle across the river. Juma, when Carr took me to Lake Turkana, he told me there's an elephant skeleton, very, very old, buried near there at Kubifora. Oh, of course it's very old if it's a skeleton. The skeleton of an East Indian elephant. Buried in East Africa? It didn't swim across the Indian Ocean. Juma thought a moment. You're talking about Carr's woman. Her name is Sheila. Well, her skeleton will belong in India. She was born in Kenya, in Lamu. All the borders are colonial. Have you thought that? The borders of all these nations were set by the English and the Germans and the French, not by the tribes. I like Sheila. I like Carr. Perhaps while you are here, I will take you to Shimoni. What's Shimoni? It means hole in the ground. It's a place on the coast. I have been there. Sheila worked for a car rental agency when Carr first met her. Perhaps you and I will go to a 3-in-1 hotel. What's a 3-in-1 hotel? You have never been to one? I don't think so. 3-in-1 bed. They are very popular here. I think they are very good, especially for a man who must treat one wife at a time. I see. Are you married, Juma? No, I want to go to school. I want to work in television. Don't you think it would be very good to work in television? Yes, I do. What is your work? Juma asked. I work for a newspaper. Oh, I see. That would be interesting work. Somewhat the same work as television, I think, except no one can see your face. If you are going to tell people something, don't you think you should say it so people can see your face? I believe it is easier to find out what to tell people if they do not see your face. Oh, I see. Yes, perhaps that is true. Juma stood up on the rock. Well, it is time for you to go have your Scotch whiskey. Why? Juma shrugged. You had a Scotch whiskey last night at this time. Chapter 32. They adore him. Who? Carr. The women just eat him up. Carr was having an after-dinner beer at the lodge's bar with the two women hoteliers who had flown up from Nairobi. Carr was sitting sideways to the bar on a stool. The two French women stood with their drinks, facing him. They laughed at everything he said. Barbara and Fletch were drinking beer at a small table at the side of the veranda. At the entrance to the veranda, a guard with a flashlight and rifle waited to escort the tourists to their cabins. Don't you find Carr attractive? Fletch asked. Barbara looked around at the few remaining tourists who had not yet gone to bed. Every woman in the place, Barbara said, is just eating him up. After clearing trails and digging holes and finding nothing significant one more day, Barbara, Fletch, and Carr had flown to Nairobi, refueled, picked the two women up, and then flown west to the Masai Mara. Sheila said she preferred to stay in camp and dig holes along the freshly cut trails. She promised she would find a Roman city before they returned. There was no discussion about whether Juma would accompany them. While they were getting ready to go, he simply did not appear. The two women hotel executives from France were très chic, très jolie. They were on a business trip, but they were also having a good time. They handed around a bottle of champagne on the airplane. Carr did not drink any. They marveled happily flying over the Rift Valley, the Leuta Hills and plains, ecologically the Serengeti Plains. Carr flew as low as he decently legally could, so they could all see the herds of zebras, elands, giraffes grazing. The older woman, who sat in the co-pilot seat, snapped photographs from the air with a little camera genuinely useless at the distance of more than 3 meters. She thought she was getting wonderful pictures. Their first sight of elephants from the air sent them into raptures. In fast, stuttering English, they were full of questions for Carr. The women were warmly greeted by management and immediately taken on a tour of Kikorok Lodge. Even Fletch wondered how a lodge so far in the bush could provide such impeccable food and drink, accommodations, and service. Carr organized a safari gwari and driver. That night and the next day, sunrise and sunset, while the hotel executives studied the operation of the lodge, Carr, Barbara, and Fletch toured the reserve. They were to be at the lodge only 2 nights before returning to Nairobi and then Carr's camp. The safari gwari was a well-spirited, well-sprung, fairly quiet Nissan van, roofless so they could stand in it, the clean bush-scented African air wind in their faces, so they could see all sides at once from an elevation of 3 meters as they rode along. Carr provided binoculars for them. They learned to brace themselves against the van's frame so they could use the binoculars reasonably well as they joggled along. They also learned from the driver, Omoke Akisi, a new way of looking at landscape, of surveying vast areas quickly, mathematically, with just their eyes, going over it in sideways Zs, spotting anything moving, anything even slightly outstanding in color. Anything remarkable spotted, Omoke would drive to, through the bush, quietly, drawing up and stopping at a decent, non-interfering, non-meddling distance. Almost immediately, Omoke found for them a lion and two lionesses sprawled in the fading sunlight. The tail and the hind legs of the lion were embraced by the forelegs of one lioness. His head and one shoulder were on the shoulder of the other lioness. Their heads were up. They were looking around lazily, the light from the low sun in their eyes. The bellies of all three were so stuffed they lay on the ground almost separately, like suitcases. Before sunrise the next morning, Omoke, who saw a landscape differently from any painter, any engineer, found a small grassy depression in the ground in the shade of a bush. Lying in the hollow, clearly exhausted, was a cheetah who, just hours before, had given birth to four. Later that afternoon, they watched the same cheetah on uncertain legs hunt, bring down and kill an eland, to feed on and to feed her young. Immediately, hyenas came and took her kill from her. They dragged it a few meters away and devoured it. The cheetah sat, blinking in the sunlight, watching them, clearly too tired to protest, to go on, just yet, or to go back foodless to her young. From the ground, even more than the beasts, the dik-diks, the zebras, Thompson's and Grant's gazelles, topis, tree and rock hyraxes, impalas, leopards, lions, waterbucks, elephants, giraffes, or down by the Mara River, the vervet monkeys, patus monkeys, olive baboons, were the birds, big and small, fascinating. The marabou storks and sacred ibises, secretary birds, Egyptian vultures, black kites, peregrines, francolins, spurfowl, bustards, plovers, turacos, the white-bellied go-away birds. Omoke had a bird book which he passed around. He knew his birds, but it was fun for Barbara and Fletch to look from this amazing bird in the bush to the book to confirm that such a creature existed and had a name and that one could believe one's eyes. Besides these specific observations, the general observation of African arithmetic is impressive. The social unit of many, if not most, species of birds and beasts is dominated by a single male. He has two wives, five wives, 10 wives, 50 wives, 70 wives. Besides bearing the children, the wives do the work of hunting and feeding. All these wives and children belong to the single male, at least as long as he can fight off whatever a young male would like to take his place. The only way this stupefying arithmetic can work out is if a shocking number of young males die trying, or so Barbara and Fletch worked out in the back of the quarry. Giraffes stretch their long necks to graze off the top of trees, their four slim legs, bodies, long, graceful necks, making something architectural out of whatever tree they graze or grace. On the way back to the lodge that second night, they stopped to watch elephants graze through a stand of long, coarse grass. An elephant uses its tusk like a spoon, its trunk like a fork. With its tusk, an elephant digs down into the earth, loosens and lifts whatever it is eating. His trunk grabs it and swings it into his mouth, grass, root, soil, all together, all the while making this wonderful rhythmical swaying movement, as if inviting someone to dance or to box. "The women are giving up," Barbara said. At the bar, the two French hotel executives had put down their empty glasses. "They are going to bed. Seeing we need an askari to escort us, I might as well leave with them." "Okay, I'll have a nightcap with Carr." After she stood up, Barbara said, "You might not find your father on this trip, but it looks to me as if you may have found your father figure." Chapter 33. "Barbara says every woman around is eating you up with her eyes," Fletch said. Carr had brought two fresh beers to the table. "Occupational hazard. Women can think bush pilots attractive, but for the most part, they'd never think of marrying one." He touched his glass to Fletcher's. "Home tomorrow to the camp and Sheila." They drank. Fletch said, "Barbara and I are very grateful to you, Mr. Peter Carr. Seeing the Maasai Mara has been a most memorable treat." "Then perhaps you'll permit me a personal question."
"Of course."
Carr took another swallow of his beer before speaking. "You've got me a bit confused, young Fletcher. I'm speaking of the murder you saw, or half-saw, at the airport." "I understand you're not running out of the men's room yelling bloody murder, or I guess I do." jet-lagged, deeply shocked, sick, newly arrived in a country foreign to you, knowing no one here, unsure of your father, his invitation, all that. Did he ever indicate to you he might meet us at the airport? But in the days since then, why haven't you come forward? Granted, the authorities here would want you to testify, might hold you over, and sooner rather than later you want to get back to your own lives in the States. But something could be worked out, don't you think? Fletch cleared his throat. My ace in the hole. You're playing poker. There are those who say life is poker. What's in the pot? My father. Oh, I see. I think I see. I'm talking about a trade-off, Carr. Carr's eyes narrowed. The senior Fletcher for a murderer. Carr, I've been listening to you all. That's what a reporter does. He listens. I'm in a country, however you love it, where a tourist is jailed, fined, and expelled for tearing a 100 shillingi note in half. Where a government driver is jailed for 18 months for parking a government car outside a bar. Where an Indian lawyer is sentenced to 7 years in prison for having $13 in his pocket. My father got into a drunken bar brawl and may or may not have slugged a cop. What's that worth in Kenyan prison time? I see. You're looking forward to doing a deal. If it comes to it, I know a deal is possible. No police in the world would fail to forgive what is essentially a misdemeanor for an eyewitness account of a murder. You're not just playing Hamlet. I see my father's ghost, and that's about all. Quietly, Carr said, you don't even know the chap. He's my father. And that means something to you? I don't know what it means to me. He ran off on you and your mother. He seems to have ignored you all your life. A few days ago in prison, he refused to see you. Am I crazy? I don't know. He also arranged for Barbara and me to come out here to meet him, spend some time with him, get to know him. There must be some feeling there, at least mild curiosity. There's a moral question here somewhere. Is there? How do I know what morals there are within a family, between a father and a son? No one ever taught me. I see. I know I don't want to see anyone who is my father spend months, years in an African prison for getting pissed and blindly swinging out at someone. Not quite what I mean. You can identify a murderer, someone who was murdered and is still at large. You mean you think he may murder again? Exactly. Don't you have the responsibility to get the chap off the streets? Fletch shook his head. No, that was a murder of impulse, of rage. I was there. The police aren't so sure, Carr said. I made a phone call while we were in Nairobi. Dan Dawes? The same. Fletch chuckled. The police informant. Right. The police inform him of everything. Bringing hard currency into Kenya isn't illegal. In fact, it's rather appreciated. Failing to declare the money upon arrival is illegal. In getting as far as the men's room without declaring this extraordinary number of Deutsche Marks, Louis Ramon, who by the way was on your airplane, had committed a crime. So? So the Kenyan police are looking for a Kenyan financial acrobat who had desperate need for that much hard currency. Wrong. The man who killed, what's his name, Louis Ramon? Right. Was not the man Louis Ramon came to meet.